Hey there, Danny with Right Foot Down. I messed up this ad read so many times because I really want to tell you about Track Monkey Apparel. They make great quality, enthusiast shirts along with hats, stickers, watches, patches, you name it. A couple of my personal favorites are their Life is Better at the Track tee and their One Track Mind tee. You should really check them out and see for yourself. Their products are great for you or the gearhead in your life. Visit trackmonkeyapparel.com.
You're listening to the Untitled Car Show in partnership with RightFootDown.com. Visit RightFootDown for your daily automotive fix. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. It's the best way to support this show. If you want to visit the archives, go to YouTube and search for Untitled Car Show. That'll bring you to the archived episodes. If you want to follow this show, just search for Untitled Car Show on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can always send an email to the show at untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. We're so glad you decided to spend the next hour or so with us. Without further ado, let's get into today's program. Thank you for joining us on today's program. I'm your host, Ike. Today we are joined by Ryan Morris. He is the Senior Manager of Public Relations over at JD Power. You may have heard of it in all the automotive commercials, and we're going to kind of delve into what a Senior Manager of Public Relations does for JD Power since we have Ryan here. Ryan, how are you doing this evening?
Doing great, Ike. How are you?
I am doing very well. Thank you very much. So, yeah, let's kind of do the, quick, what is JD Power and why should we care about what JD Power is? And then let's kind of get into what it is you do over there with them.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on the show, by the way. It's pretty cool.
Thank you for joining us.
So let's see. JD Power is a, primarily we started back in the 60s by a guy whose last name was Power, believe it or not. His first name was Dave. Essentially, it started out as a market research firm. And one of the tent poles of the business is still what it was from when it was started. He was sitting at his kitchen table one day, and he was thinking, how could I start bringing in some money? So what he did is he was into cars. He looked at the auto industry and said, hey, I bet you if I put together a survey and I surveyed people that were buying all these new cars out of Detroit, I could go and then, put that data together and then sell it back as market research to manufacturers. And, it could help them improve their cars or get more information about their customers. And that's exactly what he did. And, you fast forward several decades later, JD Power now is a massive company. We're all over the world, we do consulting to automotive manufacturers. We now have branched out of automotive. We do things like we even do studies on appliances for your home. We do ratings of wireless carriers, residential and internet service providers, and things like that. So we provide a lot of data and analytics to several different industries now in the U.S. and around the world.
That's what I kind of find fascinating, because I don't think a lot of people really understand the full bore and scope of what, JD Power is. But I'm really curious. So what is it you do with JD Power as, and I like saying this title, the Senior Manager of Public Relations? It's a fun title
right
to say.
Yeah. I have a pretty cool job. It's something that I've been angling for years. The car bug bit me at the age of 8, and I'll tell you about that later. But as Senior Manager of Public Relations, I actually do the public relations for our valuation services division of the company. If you've ever heard of NADA Used Car Guide, or you've ever been to a car dealer, or if your state makes you pay tax on your car, personal property tax every year, and you've visited your local official's office, and you see this little yellow book on the desk that says NADA Used Car Guide, it's got all the values of used vehicle market in the United States in it. And that's the division I work in. We were actually purchased from the National Automobile Dealers Association a couple years ago by J.D. Power. So they kind of just rolled us under their brand. So I get to play with all the used cars. And my main part of my job is actually to get news generated about our values that we provide and our software and services. Mm-hmm. Primarily, we're a business-to-business provider, so there's a lot of folks in the automotive industry that use our values. Like if you're a used car dealer, you need to know what the market's doing with a particular make and model of car, so you need to know how to price it. So you'll turn to our guide. State tax assessors, like I live in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, and we get to pay a lovely personal property tax every year. So the state tax assessor's office uses our values to determine what's going to be the percentage that each resident of Virginia pays on their personal property tax. And then there's lenders, insurers. They all use it to know the value of a vehicle. If you get in an accident and the vehicle's got 80,000 miles and it's 3 years old, they know how much to write that check for out to you. So there's a lot of different stakeholders that use our values. So it's pretty cool. I like it a lot.
It sounds like fun. So it is fascinating because there's, you know, a lot of people, I don't know, for whatever reason, have in their head that another, let's call them a particular colored book is like what every like dealer gets their values from. And really, if you know what you're talking about, like it's the NADA, which is, you know, because it's the Dealers Association, that's where that comes from. So I didn't realize that got scooped up by J.D. Power. So that's, you know, fascinating. I think that lends a little bit of extra credibility to being not as biased as maybe they could have been maybe in the past, because dealers, you know, have kind of a vested interest in that, whereas J.D. Power really not quite so much. So I'm curious. So you deal with the public relations side of that. Do you get more comments about cars that should be listed higher or should be listed lower in value?
Oh, man. that would be a question for our call center to answer. I'm sure their phone trees get lit up at the beginning of every month when our latest values, you know, get published. I actually also manage as part of my PR duties, I manage all of the social media for valuation services. And at least three times a week, I'll get a private message sent to the evaluation services Facebook page saying, hey, I got a Mustang. It's got 190,000 miles on it, and you're saying it's only worth, $4,000. You know, what gives? It's in mint condition. It should be worth 9,000, but it doesn't work like that. The way that we put our values together is not necessarily on your particular car, but the average of the entire market. So if you've got a Mercedes-Benz 2015 C63, right?
Yeah.
That's a pretty pricey car. You know, you're around 70K when new. But then you've got that same model year of car, and it's just the C250. C250 is probably worth, after 3 years of age or something like that, it's probably only worth like 22K, 25K. Yeah. There's going to be a massive delta, but we're looking for the average. And so when you're paying, for instance, like in Virginia, when you're paying your state tax and your tax assessor's office says, oh, we're going to make you pay a percentage of that, the person who actually wins in that scenario is the person who owns the C63, because they're basically paying a lower tax, because there aren't that many C63s out there. So they're basically getting a little bit of a discount. But that same person is probably pretty angry when they go to, try to sell their car at the dealership, and they're like, they're telling me the book value is only this much, but I think it's worth this much. But we're telling you what the market's actually doing, not what we think it should be doing. So that's something else I really love about my job is you're dealing with pretty much absolutes. You're dealing with real data that is pretty much indisputable. So it's not a matter of opinion or subjectivity. It's very objective information that you're dealing with. So it's a lot of fun helping get news generated about that. But also what's really cool is I get to, and along with our analysts, we get to experience a lot of the cars as well. Because as our analysts assess the value of vehicles, they also get pulled into several other projects in the larger body of J.D. Power. And they give feedback to manufacturers and other stakeholders on vehicles. So we actually have a pretty good cadence of cars coming through our office for test drives and stuff like that. So it's pretty cool.
I was going to say, I was curious, like, how all the research gets done with that, because I assume it's a lot of, you know, death by spreadsheet sort of deal there. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of pivot tables.
Yeah.
And for your listeners at home that don't know what a pivot table is, God bless them. yeah, but it's big data. I mean, essentially what we really are, you know, J.D. Power started out as a market research firm, but where we really are now is we're a data and analytics firm. Mm-hmm. We're kind of, I think where we're getting more and more positioned is we're kind of the Google of the information about vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're really putting the technology spin on. We got a bunch of apps that we actually have for the valuation services division that I work in that dealers and other stakeholders can use. You know, you can scan a VIN and you can instantly tell how much that car sold for at wholesale auction. If you're a dealer, you want to know that because then you know how much to offer the next time you go and buy some inventory to put on your used lot. So you make sure you're not, you know, going to lose money when you try to resell them. J.D. Power has some great apps that actually we're going to be coming out with soon. That's kind of hush-hush now, so I can't really say anything more. But pretty cool stuff.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was, I'm 99% positive, it was the NADA when I looked up my Volvo, who said basically that it was worth negative money. Like... Which I love because it was like I think it was Doug DeMiro put out like if whoever can find their car, whoever car they're driving right now that's worth the least amount of money, it is hard to beat negative cash on that. So
you're paying to give it away, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and they were not wrong because that car even it was in better shape than it is now, which is not saying much. But yeah, that car was definitely like someone's got to come pay to get this taken away. So I'm curious then, so, you know, let's take a step back here and I'm curious, how'd you get from, you know, you came into this wide, wonderful world with, you know, so many options ahead of you and you went car guy and then into J.D. Power of all things. Kind of take us on the journey. Like, how did you discover cars?
Yes. This is a favorite question and a favorite anecdote that every single automotive journalist, while right now I'm a PR guy by day, I've been on tons of media drives, you know, where journalists from around the world, we meet up with, at the invitation of a manufacturer and we test drive a brand new car and, you know, do a review of it. But this is a common story you'll see over a late night after driving when everyone's back in the hotel lobby and you're having old fashions or something like that. But so here's my story. I'll try to do it in 45 seconds or less. When I was 8, I'm a military brat. My dad was an officer in the Air Force, and we were stationed in the D.C. area. My dad was doing his tour at the Pentagon, like most middle and senior doing a point in their career. And it was a Friday. I'm 8 years old. And we lived on this, like, private drive, so it was a really long driveway. And I'm out front juggling my soccer ball, and I hear this engine, and I'd never heard an engine like that before. I'd never heard what this engine was doing. And as I saw this red car come down the driveway, I realized my father was driving this car. And not only was it just a red car with a cool sounding engine, but it was a Porsche 911 Targa. It was a 74. And it was beautiful. It was guards red. And that sound that I heard, my dad was actually a special agent in the Air Force. So he's done tons of high pursuit driving. He's done all these crazy training courses. He knows how to hustle a car quickly. And so when he's coming down the driveway, what I heard was that flat six downshifting and a perfect amount of, you know, off the gas and releasing the clutch and perfect timing. And right then and there, the car bug bit me. And I knew that eventually I was going to, when I grew up one day and I became an adult, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with cars in some capacity. So by age eight, I already knew what I was going to end up doing. So I was kind of donezo there.
Yeah, so obviously dad bit of a car guy too, if he went out and bought a 911 Targa.
Well, then he didn't have 911 money. I mean, pretty much only generals do. I have a couple other siblings, and he came home on a Friday, and what happened is there was a bachelor officer in his office at the Pentagon that threw him the keys to the car and said, "Hey man, I got a PCS," which means in military speak means permanent change of station. It means you're going to move. He's like, "Hey man, I got a PCS across the country, and I've already moved the sports car like five other times. You know, I don't want to bring it with me, but I know you're into cars. You should take it home for the weekend and drive it and see what you think." So my dad's like, "Ah, I got kids. They're going to be heading off to college eventually." No. But he throws the keys in my dad's hand. My dad brought it home. And so we pretty much joyrided the whole weekend. My dad took me on some back roads. We had the Targa top off. I got to watch his footwork in the pedal box and just watch his hands, you know, go over the shifter. And it was just a great bonding moment, you know, as father and son and this awesome, phenomenal flat six boxer engine. I mean, just super cool. Mm-hmm. So from there, I was hooked. Of course, dad didn't end up buying the car. I think we ended up getting an 86 Toyota Cressida. So definitely not as cool.
It's a little different, I guess. I mean, the Cressida was probably had more technology in it, maybe.
It had an LCD dash, which was kind of very Knight Rider ish. Yeah. So that was cool. But yeah, definitely didn't rip through corners the way that 911 did.
No, I bet not. So, your, you know, poor father, you know, got the taste of the 911, and then he's going into Cressidas and all that. So did he ever try to live vicariously through you via, you know, the...
He actually, you know, before I was born, he had a pretty good run. When my mom and him, it was just my mom and him before any of their kids were born. His first assignment when he was a second lieutenant, when he just got his commission in the Air Force, he had a Triumph, I think he said it was a Triumph TR4, which was a pretty cool little roadster. And he also had a Datsun 2000, which, man, if he had that today, that would be so cool, because the JDM stuff is really doing well right now.
Yeah, it is.
And let's see, what else? I think he might have had one other car before we were born, but then once the family started, you know, and we moved around a lot. We moved about every 2 to 3.5 years. So then it just became a game of, you know, get something practical that could drive long distances when needed the next time we did.
Yeah. Makes sense. So
yeah.
When you got into driving age, then what was the first car you got into?
Oh man, I had a real crap box. the company has definitely come a long way. If you look at the JD Power initial quality surveys, the Hyundai has, you know, grown leaps and bounds since the 80s. My first car was, I was the third owner of it. My sister was the second owner. She used it at college. My dad bought it for her use. It was an 86 Hyundai Excel. if you remember, the 86 was the first year, I believe, that Hyundai brought the Excel to America. It was their debut year. It's a little five-speed, four-door. When you hit about 50 miles per hour on the B roads, the rear view mirror would vibrate and literally turn around, so you had to always keep your hand on it, otherwise you couldn't see the traffic behind it from the vibrations. But the thing ran like a top. It would not die. We ended up putting almost 300,000 miles on that little four banger and donating it by the time I headed off to college.
Oh, wow. See, now that's proof, because, you know, a lot of times we get, you know, what was your first car? And inevitably it ends up in a ditch or, you know, crash somewhere. If you give your kid an 86 Hyundai, they don't have enough power to get into trouble. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, also that was a great car though, because it was, you know, I think it had maybe 80 horsepower, 70 horsepower, something like that. You could never go fast. I had drum brakes, so even if you could go fast, you weren't going to stop fast, so you always had to be mindful of that. But it was a five-speed, and so I learned that my first car that I ever was responsible for, I learned how to drive a proper manual, and it's a skill that I've used ever since, definitely in my professional career. But I've done a lot of overseas travel where mostly, especially in Europe, it's, if you ever rent a car, it's a lot harder to find an automatic than it is a manual. Mm-hmm. So it was a great experience. Probably wouldn't buy one for my own son when he's of age. No airbags, nothing in it. I mean, but yeah, I, every once in a while, I'll see one of those on the road, and it makes me feel old, because then I realize that car is, you know, from the mid 80s. But it brings back some good memories too, because I definitely had a lot of fun. You know, when you're 16, you're hanging out with your boys. It's, you always get in hijinks somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have tried to do a couple J turns in it, maybe in the high school parking lot, unsuccessfully.
I've just pictured like trying to like hoon in a Hyundai from 86. Like, it's a Hyundai Excel, yay!
It was on Excel, and it was front wheel drive too, so you weren't exactly drifting.
No, there's not much you can do in that. I mean, I like too that it gave it such a, you know, they call it an Excel because that's the one thing you can't do in it. Like,
yeah, it's definitely a far contrast from what Hyundai is putting out now. I mean, I just had a Hyundai Santa Fe 7-passenger crossover last week that I was test driving for the week, and that was just absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally felt like a baby Audi Q7, just with a much nicer price point, but a lot of the same features. So,
no, I love Hyundai now. Like, again, the two brands in the 80s where if no one loved you, they would let you go buy their product was Audi and Hyundai, and now they're like two of the better brands. I don't know
exactly. Yeah, what exactly? Yeah,
they got it sorted out. I don't know what like. Bye, honey. I'm going to go look for a car. Where are you going? I'm going to go look at Hyundai, and I'm going to swing by Audi. Like, and if she didn't tackle you and just start punching you in the face, like, snap out of it. You've gone crazy. That's no lie.
Yeah, they just matured. You know, they came to their own. So they're having a good stride, both companies, right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm waiting for Hyundai to put out, because they, random aside on that, like, they've been putting out like super competitive cars and like all that space, and they do seem to like try and punch above their weight, like you know, the Japanese cars with like the Acura NSX, they're like trying to take on the, you know, Italian supercar sort of stuff, mm-hmm. at like a lower price point and like better quality. It seems like Hyundai's like, we're just going to take on the Germans and try and beat them on the price point. So when
and this is just me speaking subjectively. This is not, you know, necessarily the viewpoint of J.D. Power or anything like that. But what I've noticed is any media drive I've been on or any car I've reviewed by Kia/Hyundai, they just tend to add like 5 to 10% more stuff than you could get on a lot of competitors' cars for the same price, or maybe even slightly less. They have a lot less trim levels than a lot of their competitors. Yeah. So you pretty much, when you buy a Hyundai or a Kia, it's like, you know, almost loaded or like fully loaded, you know, it seems in some of their particular models. So they're just doing well. And like you said, I think saying that they're punching above their weight class, you know, I think it's definitely true. And it seems to be working for them.
Oh, yeah.
Because their volume has definitely gone up over the years.
Yeah, I'm waiting for, I know they're going to do it eventually. I just have this feeling in the back of my head that there's going to be it'll probably be a Genesis now, but like some sort of like hyper / supercar from Hyundai. Like,
yeah, I'm waiting. It was Hyundai that came out with the N. I think it's the N series, which is kind of like their answer to the M.
Yeah.
The M, or, you know, AMG from Mercedes, or S or RS from Audi. Yeah, I'm waiting for something like that where we go to a car show, one of the international car shows later. Could be in LA, you know, in November, or maybe in Detroit in January. And they just kind of come out and then they're just like, here's our 600 horsepower four-door sedan, and it's only going to be $50,000 instead of $115,000 or something like that. I mean, I could see them doing that. Yeah. And kind of disrupting that little tiny segment of the market. Yeah.
No, they're crazy when it comes to that. So, random Hyundai aside, so after you got out of your, I was going to call it Wonderful Excel, but like even the hyperbole or like the sarcasm there doesn't quite fit. So after you survived the Excel, what did you get into?
So after that, I drove that. That got me through high school. I went away. I was actually living in Virginia at the time, and I went away to college at the University of Florida. And when after I finished my first year, I had been saving through high school and working a job in college. I really needed a car that I could drive the 780 miles to get from the DC area down to Gainesville, Florida, safely. And so my dad and I talked about it, and my mom was on board with the idea. And so he and I went out and we started looking through the classifieds, and I realized, you know, probably all I needed was something that I could get a futon in the back of and had like a 10-disc CD changer in it. And the Honda Accord Coupe, a 94 Honda Accord Coupe EX fit the bill. So I bought it off a school teacher. I remember it had 27,000 miles on it. It was like that champagne. I can't remember the official Honda paint code color name for it, but it was like a champagne gold, mm-hmm. with a beige upholstery. Yeah, man, I put my Sony Explode 10-disc CD player in there and, you know, rode I-95 for 12 hours all the way down and got there safely and back dozens of times. And I drove that all the way up until the early 2000s, when Mini Cooper made their comeback. BMW, you know, bought the licensing to that brand and built up the new generation Mini Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what my next car was going to be as soon as I saw that. I'd already been a fan of that brand, and I remember reading about the rallies that John Cooper Works used to participate in. So I graduated from college. I moved back to the DC area. And I'd been working in communications for a nonprofit, actually, downtown in D.C. And then I ended up getting a job during the era. It was post-dot-com bust, and right when dot-com started making a rise again. AOL actually used to be headquartered in Northern Virginia. So I took a job with them, and working for a tech company, your salary goes up a lot. So then I was able to afford a pretty much fully specced out, fully loaded 2006 Mini Cooper S that I put probably $3,000 worth of customized parts on and had a lot of fun doing it. So that's when, once I was able to start really affording better toys, that's when it just kind of got off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to take a guess here. So, based on the cars you've owned, I'm going to guess you're a little over 6 feet.
No, I'm actually not. I tend to, you know, it's funny. I was actually talking to a coworker about that a couple of weeks ago. That I tend to drive cars that generally taller people would have. No, I'm actually only 5'8".
I mean, short fella, but because the Mini Cooper and like the Accord Coupe, they're like great cars if you're like taller than 6 foot, because like for whatever reason they just work. I don't know if it's the roof line. The Mini is still the one that boggles my mind the most, because I've seen like 7 foot people get out of Minis and it's like, yeah, it's comfortable in there. It's like I think part of it is the seat goes so far back in both cars because they're coupes, I guess. But even like I'm 6'2" and my Dodge Challenger, and I was pushing it in terms of height. So, right. But Mini Cooper, I fit in comfortably. So that's crazy to me. So I'm going to assume here that you don't have, this is me going out and using my professional knowledge here. So Mini Cooper, you put $3,000 worth of work into it. I'm going to guess, something terrible happened on one of the terrible roads out here to the suspension, and you no longer have that vehicle?
You're close. It wasn't a relationship, you know, ender with the car. What had happened is, I put some new suspension on it. I did a 15% reduction pulley on the supercharger, exhaust. And I ripped out the first day I actually had it, I ripped out all the interior, dynamatted the whole thing, and put in a Pioneer. You could get navigation on that car back then, but it was really horrible. So I just put in an aftermarket system that had navigation built in, one of those flip screen type DIN chassis setups. And as I was doing it, I was like, I should upgrade the speakers too. So then that, you know, ended up me ripping everything out and putting in Dynamat and putting everything back together. And then about a year and a half later, I was like, I think I want to add exhaust. And then I was like, but if I'm going to put on exhaust, I should, you know, do suspension. And so it was a slippery walk. So I did all that. Driving around Northern Virginia, you know, every couple of years we get a big snowstorm, and then that's when all the potholes start to form. They're nowhere near like the potholes in Detroit or other areas of the U.S. But on the firm ride of a Mini Cooper S with aftermarket suspension, they will beat the hell out of your rims, and they will mushroom your strut tower supports on the front of your vehicle. So that's pretty much what happened. That first model generation is known for mushrooming on the towers, underneath the bonnet. And I didn't get the full-on Mario Kart mushroom, but it was definitely getting close. And at that point, though, I had already had the car, I think, for 4.5 years, almost 5 years. And I had met a nice woman who I knew I wanted to settle down with, and we were already talking about, you know, getting married one day, and we wanted to become a single car household, because actually where we lived was right on the mass transit line. We realized we didn't need both her car and my car. So I was trying to hold on to my car, but God bless her. She just tore the hell out of the transmission trying to shift it. And you get a lot of clutch smell. So then that meant, and I knew where we were headed. I knew it was probably only a matter of a year or two until we started trying to, increase the size of the family and stuff like that. And the Mini Cooper wasn't going to fit the bill. So I ended up from there. I had the Mini Cooper S, and I traded her in for a four-door car. I got a 2010 Mercedes-Benz C300. Which was very different, definitely not as sport specific as the Mini, and I did miss rowing through the gears. But you know, it fit the bill for what I needed, and I do have a natural bend to go toward luxury cars. I got the sport version, of course, but you know, nowhere near as raw and visceral as the little mighty Mini Cooper S.
A lot better for Northern Virginia, though, for sure.
Oh, Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I never had the mushrooming, shock tower problem or, bent rims or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I guess carrying on with the car history, from there, we had just been living in an apartment just outside of D.C., and that's when we decided we were going to start a family. So, we move out to the burbs and into a regular house, and, all the rage, of course, around 2012. Mm-hmm. You start a family, you get an SUV or a minivan. Yeah. And I knew I didn't want to have, I knew I would die and implode if I got a minivan. So the compromise with my better half was a crossover vehicle. So we ended up getting a BMW X3, and I'd been building it on the configurator for a few months before I actually ended up pulling the trigger. But I was very specific about what I wanted on it, and one of the things I knew I wanted on it was the M Sport package. I wanted some aspect of performance on it. But it turned out there was a dealer in Philadelphia who had the exact same color interior. It was a brown saddle leather color, almost like a chestnut, I guess.
Yeah.
with a carbon gray outside, panoramic sunroof, and it had pretty much every option on it. Because the plan was to just drive this car until the wheels fell off. And hold on to it for 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
But, as luck would have it.
that never happens with us car guys, does it?
That never happens with those cars. It actually ended up becoming a bit of a mechanical test. When you buy a BMW, they come with a warranty that includes maintenance for 4 years or 50,000 miles.
Yeah.
Well, we started getting up on that 50,000 mile mark. I took it in for service, just expecting that they would, it would be our last free oil change and our last free, pair of windshield wipers. And, my wife actually ended up picking up the car the next day, and she brought it back and she gave me the paperwork because we like to keep everything organized and put it away in the file for the car. And I realized the work order was 4 pages long. And I was like, what happened with the car? So I start reading through it. It had almost $7,000 worth of warranty work done on it.
Oh, God.
And I was like, what? So I'm reading through this, and I'm reading all the codes and everything, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. BMW's had a mixed love with, if you look at cars, especially the previous generation of cars, the oil pans tend to leak. It's where the gasket mates to the main part of the engine.
Yeah.
I kind of just learned to accept it, but when it's $7,000, I'm kind of like, I don't think I can accept that. luckily it was all covered under the warranty. But I then went on the BMW forums that I was pretty active on at the time, and I realized that a lot of people, it was happening again to them in the next 15 to 20,000 miles.
Oof.
And I was like, I don't want to get hit with that.
Yeah.
So using the NADA used car guide, our values, I punched in the odometer reading and I'm pretty detailed and anal with my cars, as you can imagine being a car guy. Yeah. So it was in great shape. It was super clean, and I pulled the value for it, and I realized that I could probably just take it to CarMax and give it to them. They'd give me the quote, that NADA had given them. So I already knew what the value was going to be before I even walked in there. And I ended up with our work changed. My wife's work changed, and the way that she got to work changed and everything. So actually we went from driving a lot with that vehicle and putting a lot of miles on it to now where my wife really only needed a car that she was going to put maybe 6 miles on a day, because she was just driving to a commuter lot and then taking mass transit to get to work.
Oh, wow.
So we ended up leasing, we went back to the C-Class. We ended up leasing a new 2016 C300, which is that new model generation that you currently see on the roads. And she loves it. She absolutely loves it. So it's been a good fit for our new change in life with such a limited amount of commuting that she does now. So
that's wonderful. So I do love the, first of all, we got to touch on this. So I am of the opinion, I love minivans because they announce to the world, this car is built for having kids in it, and screw all the rest of you and your plans with your, listen, this is the future of our world, and we're going to go on with it. Whereas I feel the SUV is announcing to the world, like, it's the bald guy who's trying to cover it with the comb over, whereas the minivan is the guy who just says, you know what, fuck it, just shave this whole thing off, and hey, look, I look even better than I did before. That's the way I
well,
look
I'll
at
tell
it.
You what. Yeah. I'll tell you what, to your point, man. Well, I will say this, you know, while I didn't want to have a minivan myself, we did a family vacation down to the Outer Banks in North Carolina. It's a great, if your listeners aren't familiar with it, the Outer Banks are some really pretty awesome beaches on the North Carolina coast. I highly recommend going down there. You just rent a beach house with some friends or some family members and stay down there a week. You have a blast. I had gotten in contact with Honda because, as I was seeing, I review cars every week. And I took a shot in the dark. You know, I was wondering if maybe I could finally get a minivan for one of our to review that then I could also, you know, have a double purpose of using on our family vacation. And lo and behold, the timing was right. And Chris Naughton over at Honda, he set me up with a fully loaded Honda Odyssey.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I have two little kids. I have a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. That was the best experience ever in a road trip ever in my entire life. And that means a lot coming from me because – I've moved, being a military brat, I've moved 26 times in my life between my father's career and just my own moving as a civilian. And a lot of that involved very long road trips with family members in hot cars like old Buicks and stuff like that, Chevy Malibus and stuff like that, driving across in the Nevada desert. This was the most civil, best thing. You know, the kids got sand in the car when we're down there at the beach. It has a built-in shop vac,
yeah.
Literally licensed by shop vac in the back with enough hose to vacuum out the entire vehicle. It's got an amazing infotainment system. It's got great gas mileage. And I could go on and on. It was a phenomenal car that if you do have to do the minivan thing, that'd definitely be the one that I think you should go and check out.
Mm-hmm. See, I think the minivan gets a bad rap because it's like, it's a tool built for a purpose and
right.
Like, you know, no matter how good your multi-tool ever is, you know, a proper screwdriver or something else would just be better. And I feel like, maybe just the minivan name gives it a bad name. When my Challengers would break down all the time and I got really cozy with all the guys working at Enterprise who would just give me the car every time I went to the dealership, like, Ike's here again. All right, bring around another car. What's he going to be driving this week? And it was like, they would refer to, you know, they'd be like, bring out the swag wagon. I'm like, what the hell is a swag wagon? Well, that's what we call minivans. I'm like, I'm going to just call minivans swag wagons from now on because that's just the best way to refer to them. It's like, you can make babies in the back of minivan too. I'm just saying, you know, there's enough space for it. And you can do whatever your weird kink is back there, and if you get a, you know, one that has the shop vac built in, you can clean up afterwards. It's perfect.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's pretty cool. The shop vac was like a definite must, especially if you have kids with Cheerios. Those find them, you know, they go in every single crevice. The shop vac was key for that. But another thing cool thing was there's a feature. I think it was called Cabin Talk. Where if your child, so this car had like the screen that folds down from the ceiling so your kids can watch any movie they want on Blu-ray. They can plug in a video device and get up. They can watch streaming videos on it because the car has a hotspot in it. But the thing that was cool is both my kids are in the car seats and they're watching this movie. We're into like hour four of the drive down to the Outer Banks. They both got their wireless headsets on that, you know, speak to the car. And my wife is telling them, you know, speaking up and saying, hey, we're going to stop and get lunch. And they are completely oblivious to what she's saying. She hits the cabin talk option on the infotainment screen, and it's literally this private peer-to-peer intercom that goes in through the wireless headsets, and you can hear mommy's voice all of a sudden. It was just so cool. And then our kids are like, oh, we're going to stop for, you know, lunch. Okay. Mm-hmm. So just a cool car with a lot of cool toys that I was pleasantly surprised all the, you know, the cool tech that it had in it. So yeah, but like you said, it's a perfect purpose-built tool. You wouldn't race one in the 24-hour Le Mans. You'd take a
Maybe you want it. I may. You don't even need to swap. But, you don't even need to stop to swap drivers. Just put them in the back. You can sleep in the.
Right.
Yeah, it's perfect. I got a brilliant. That's why I'm going to go pitch Porsche. Listen, this is going to sound crazy, but or go to Honda. Like, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to take the minivan and go race it. Yeah, I feel like we might be spending a little bit too much time. Even I'm thinking maybe we're spending a little bit too much time talking about the minivans here. So let's talk about you reviewing cars here. So how did you get into that, and where can we find your work of reviewing cars?
Sure. You know, that's a question I get asked often. And a lot of times when I meet people at, you know, parties or get-togethers where they're like, hey, so what do you do for a living? My go-to is actually always I'm a car journalist. Because that's kind of the way I've always thought of myself. I've been writing about transportation issues since about 2002. I used to work for a bicycling nonprofit over on K Street in D.C., and that's I was associate editor of our magazine, and we wrote a lot about safe cycling in the United States, alternative transportation, things like that. And then from there, it kind of segued into several other outlets. But when I really got totally into the car world, it was about 10 years ago now. And it was from good old nepotism.
Thanks,
which,
nepotism.
Which actually happens. It happens a lot more in this industry than I thought was ever possible. There's a lot of generations of people that have been in this industry. But the way it happened for me was my wife, we hadn't even gotten engaged yet. We were just dating at the time. I went to a wedding with my wife, and it was actually for her sister. Her youngest sister was getting married. And my wife's uncle shows up in this pretty sweet Infiniti SUV, and I started talking to him, and it turns out he was like a car guy through and through. He had worked at GM as an executive. He had graduated back in the day from their vehicle institute. I think it's called, isn't it Kettering Institute? He had lived abroad. He lived all over the United States. He worked at AAA in the industry. And then he owned his own website called All About Autos, and it was a very simple website. But he was also more importantly in his outlet, he was a North American car, juror, North American car of the year juror. Mm. And, so he was the real deal, and he saw how passionate I was, because what we ended up doing the 5 hours the wedding reception was going, we were just hanging out in the parking lot in his car, just talking about horsepower. I think we might have gone to one of the buffet tables and grabbed some gin and tonics and brought them back to the car to talk more. But we bonded. And by the end of the evening, he was like, I had asked him, so how do I break into this industry? Because my true passion is to be fully 100% in this industry and just writing and talking and dealing with subject matter of cars. And he's like, tell you what, I got this website. Write me 600 words on any car you want to review, and I'll take a look at it. And that's what he did. And so I went home, and that week I went to my local Mercedes dealership, and I jumped in. I think it was a C class actually, and I went on a test drive in it, and I wrote my 600 words, and I shot it back to him, and he saw something in my writing, and before I knew it, a couple months later, I was on a plane to Las Vegas to review the newly introduced Fiat 500s that were coming to the United States.
Oh, wow.
So I got to do the Fiat 500. I think it was either the Fiat 500, a Barth drive was my first drive, or perhaps it was the Mercedes GL, their big 7-passenger SUV. Yeah. And then from there, I mean, I was like on a plane, you know, every other week to somewhere in the U.S. To go on media drives and do written reviews and take pictures and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of my content got hosted on his site. And then from there, it actually worked. My day job at the time, I was a contractor working for AARP, of all places. their headquarters is downtown in D.C., and they have a digital strategy operations division, and one of the verticals that I was responsible for was producing content about personal technology and transportation. And so cars, of course, was included in that. And pretty soon I was able to start writing stuff about vehicles that got listed on there because I was going on these trips. And then on these trips also, I started meeting other journalists that had other outlets. Video back then, this is around like 2011, 2010, I believe, really started to take off and be the number one consumable on the internet. And I met Roman Mica. He's the publisher of the FastLaneCar.com. Mm-hmm. And they were one of the first sites to do 4K reviews, actually, now. But they always did high-def video reviews, and I met him on one of the drives, and we hit it off, and then I started writing and doing on-video work for him for a couple years. And, you know, now I have something on the side now called AutoMentality.com. You guys, readers should go, or listeners should go check it out. But it's pretty much where my work at J.D. Power ends now. I get to do this in the evening, and we tend to cover, you know, with the valuation services division I work in, we tend to cover more of the mainstream and luxury cars, but stuff that isn't too crazy. You're not going to see prices for Bugattis or, you know, Koenigseggs or anything like that. But that's kind of where auto mentality then starts to hew in on. We do a lot more of the ultra high performance, ultra luxury highline vehicles that we do over there. So it's been a great run so far. I've really enjoyed it, and I've met some just really amazing people. Some people that are my heroes in the automotive journalism world, like Jean Jennings. She used to be the editor of Automobile Magazine. She's a hoot to hang out with. Of course, Patrick George, he's a contemporary, but he's killing it over at Jalopnik. He's a good guy to hang out with. You know, there's a bunch of people that you meet, and you meet some really good relationships. It's just been a blast.
You know, it's on that note, my favorite thing in this industry, and part of the reason I love doing specifically the podcast aspect of it, is everyone in this industry that I've interacted with very few exceptions, is wonderfully pleasant. Everyone seems to understand, like, it's, you know, I guess maybe we're all in the same little, like, we're all car nerds and we all just want to kind of share our enthusiasm with each other. But, like, there's no, for lack of a better term, like, dick measuring contest really going on. Like, I've approached crazy people. I've had Bob Lutz on, for fuck's sake. Like, there's no reason I should ever have talked to that man. Like, but it's awesome that sort of stuff happens. And, like, you know, Patrick George is a wonderful guy. Yourself, wonderful guy. It's so, I just love this industry. Like, outside of just the car aspect of it, just dealing with people is so wonderful. So,
yeah, I definitely got to agree with you. It's, I don't know what it is. Like you said, I don't know if it's because we're all car nerds or what, but you know, maybe. Well, I'll take a shot at it. Maybe it's just because we're so passionate about this. I mean, who really gets? Most people don't get to work in the field, you know, that they really dream about. You know, life happens, you know, and you end up getting pulled in different directions or, you know, whatever. So to be able to, like, be able to afford a mortgage and, you know, still play with cars is, you know, it's truly a blessing. So I just love it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're getting close up on time here. I don't want to keep you too late, and I unfortunately have a deadline myself. So we're going to – I have to know this story. Your kid fell asleep while you were doing 187 miles per hour?
yes. So before Child Protective Services breaks down my door, this did not happen in the United States. And I was not in any normal car, and I was not on any normal road. What had happened is a couple years ago, my firstborn, she was about, I think she was around a little over 2 years old. My wife and I, we were in, Germany, and as you do when in Germany, you go to all the car museums. So Porsche has a pretty cool program that if you ever get the chance or if any of your listeners get a chance to go to Germany, I highly recommend it if you find yourself in Stuttgart. They've got the Porsche Museum there, so you can go and just drool over all the cars. But they also have something called the Porsche Drive Program.
Mm-hmm.
As a car journalist, Porsche might send me a car to review, and that's the ultimate best way to experience a Porsche. It's totally free, right?
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, you know, that's probably not an option if you're not an automotive journalist. But what they have is they have this program where if you bring a license, it can be a U.S. license, it can be a license from anywhere else in the world. If you bring a license and a credit card, you can plunk those down on the counter and reserve any Porsche you want that's in their stable. And you can go drive it for as long as you want anywhere in Germany. So it's a pretty cool program. So for a couple hundred bucks, I plunked down my Virginia's driver's license, a couple hundred bucks, and I leased for 4 hours a 911 4S Cabriolet. I wanted the Targa because I was trying to relive that childhood dream, but it was actually up on the lift getting repaired, so they stuck me in a Cabriolet. So I put my daughter in her child seat in the back, wrenched it down, got in the car and headed north on the Autobahn to where there's an unregulated zone. And I was going down in the right lane. They're very specific about the way you're supposed to drive on the Autobahn. I was going down in the right lane, and I moved over to the left, and the left in Germany is the, you know, schnell. It's the go-fast lane. It's only meant for passing or if you're really flying. And as I was in the right lane, I just noticed, like, Audi A8 would just blow my doors off. And I'm in this I'm in a $140,000 sports car, and Audi A8 blows my doors off. BMW B7, Alpina B7 blows my doors off. Then this big, you know, S600 Mercedes goes by. So I'm like, all right, I got to get past this lorry that I'm coming up on. So I mosey on over into the left lane, and I start seeing a headlights come up on me, and then there's a long column of 18-wheelers in the right lane. So I realize in Germany, if you do not floor it when someone has their headlights on and they're coming at you during daytime, that's just forbidden. You don't do that. You get out of the way or you speed up.
Yeah.
So my only option was to speed up. Well, I floored it, and before you knew it, we're doing 187. So, and I did actually end up catching up to that, the Alpina B7. And then I moved over into the right lane, and, the car that actually was behind me, was a Lamborghini, Huracan. So it was pretty amazing, to see that. And it was just like, it was a perfectly sunny day. It was a great day. I got passed by all these amazing cars. I was in an amazing car. And then, of course, as this is all happening, my 2-year-old falls asleep and was completely not aware to anything that occurred. So that was kind of the buzzkill. But the funny part is I have this all on GoPro. So
nice. Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe if I send it to you, you can list it on your site or something like that. But yeah, that's the 187 miles per hour with the 2-year-old in the back who was blissfully asleep to the sound of a flat six.
That's awesome. Well, that's absolutely perfect. That it's a soothing sound to the youngins. So since we're going a little bit long here on time, I'm going to go ahead and give you the one question I always need to ask a guest, and I do think it's the most important question that really any automotive journalist can ask, maybe any journalist or person can ask really in the history of time, and that is, what is the hardest food to eat while driving?
The hardest food to eat?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm, that's a good one. I would probably say... I think it's got to be like lo mein noodles, but there's kind of a caveat here. It's got to be with chopsticks.
Mm-hmm.
That's tough because that's a greasy food, and you will get it like all over your pants. Like, don't wear white jeans and eat lo mein with chopsticks in the car.
And there's a scald hazard in there too. That's a good answer.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm thinking, and I mean you're pretty much screwed if it's a manual. I mean, if it's a manual, I don't know how you manage that without taking your other hand completely off the wheel there.
I will say, as this often devolves into stupid shit Ike's done in cars, I have eaten sushi with chopsticks while driving a manual transmission. So, Ryan, you're an absolutely fascinating individual. We're going to have to get you back on and ask you some more questions here. I appreciate you joining us this evening. Once again, just tell everyone where they can find your work, where they can find, you know, what you do online with Automentality and with J.D. Power, and just kind of give us the places to go.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, first and foremost, be sure to check out jdpower.com, of course. You can also, if you need any information on your used car, how much it's worth, you can go to nataguides.com. Or if you want to see kind of what the used market's doing and where the best deals are, you can read our reports all about that in our guidelines report on nada.com/B2B. And then my last plug would be Automentality. If you are into car culture, vintage stuff, and supercars, and ultra-high luxury cars, be sure to check out automentality.com.
Excellent. Ryan, I'm going to say goodbye to you off air. Everyone listening, I will be right back after the quick break. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure you tell a friend, tell a loved one, coworker, just tell anyone who you think may enjoy listening to the show. You can follow us on all social media at Entitled Car Show, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all that stuff. And thanks everyone so much for listening. Make sure you can follow our West Coast correspondent, Ryan West, at RyanNader122 on the Twitters. And have a good night. Have a good evening, wherever you are, whatever time it is there. Thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there.